This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network. Visit jabberjawmedia.com for more shows like this one.
Coming January 18th, 2019, Misery Never Forgets, the new album from the leaders of the next generation of metalcore, Wrist Meat Razor. Revolver magazine proclaims, Wrist Meat Razor reimagined the technicality and urgency of the hardcore and screamo of the early aughts. And Cult Nation hails, Wrist Meat Razor is poised to make their mark, a crimson slice of emotional violence. Wrist Meat Razor, Misery Never Forgets, available in all formats, January 18, 2019. Pre-order at store.prostheticrecords.com.
He knows the law.
I know the law.
And he came to fight.
Your Honor, my client has already admitted to assault, but did the defendant admit to not wanting to have sex with my client after he clearly showed her his erection?
Say hello to Trevor Spandaloid, the intelligent lawyer.
If you have been accused of sexual harassment, sexual assault, domestic violence, rape, statutory rape, murder, or if you're trying to divorce that second-class citizen you married, call me. I'll fight for my virgin brothers.
The intelligent lawyer won't back down.
Would you say that on the night of November 27th, you were, in fact, being a bitch?
Yeah, maybe, but that was after he punched me.
So you do admit to being a bitch. No further questions.
If one of these skanks takes you to court because you reacted to them not coughing up the sniz that is rightfully yours, call Trevor and he'll get to work immediately.
So you claim he grabbed your breasts without consent?
Yes.
I'd like to call on the jury so that they may analyze the plaintiff's chest. Notice how she barely has an A cup. What self-respecting man would willingly lay his hands on those colossal disappointments? The defense rests.
The intelligent lawyer. Because getting puss is a right, not a privilege.
It's the Metal Sucks Podcast with your hosts Petter Spych, Brandon Hahn, and Jocelyn Sharp.
What is going on, everybody? Hey, it's I, Petter Spych. And I'm always joined by...
It's me, Val, Brandon Gooch Hahn. And you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Your Buddy Gooch.
And...
Jocelyn Sharp. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Jocelyn Sharp.
And I am at Rise to Offend on Facebook and Twitter. Rise to Offend Official on Instagram. Guys, this week we got Dave Elphison from fucking Megadeth. We're here to talk about Altitudes and Attitudes and many other things, Metal Allegiance, all the stuff. The dude's been nonstop busy, but we want to let you guys know that Altitudes and Attitudes, Get It Out, is out right now, and Megadeth's greatest hits record, Warheads on Foreheads, is coming out March 22nd. Now, I feel we have to explain our bit a little bit, because I did not know what an incel, correct?
Yes.
Incel was.
Well, yeah. That's because women willingly fucked you when you were an adolescent.
Yeah, yeah. I feel horrible for men these days because they're like the younger men. They're incels and cuckolds.
But they are incels.
But that's what I'm saying. These are real things.
Yeah. You can't say. Why would you feel so horrible for
not
the young?
Not for men. For the young dudes that. This is pretty rough.
No, I feel horrible for no one. In this situation, Why would you feel bad for anyone?
These are voluntary people, right? I don't understand what an incel is.
I feel bad for the normal dudes that have to prove that they're not an incel or a cuck.
There you go.
That's what I meant. Yeah. Now, just so I'm sure.
I swear I don't want to watch you get fucked by another dude. I swear.
I feel so much older. Explain an incel to me one more time, Jocelyn.
Well, an incel is like a dude who like... Okay, I know I explained everything like a valley girl, but that's who I am as a person.
So,
incels are like dudes that go on YouTube and they make these vlogs and they're like, well, women won't fuck me, so I'm going to shoot up a 7-Eleven.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
That's it, yeah. Yeah. It's like they go on the internet and all they do is they might not want to kill women, but they hate them. Like, they vehemently hate them.
Because they won't fuck them.
Right,
like,
that's it.
Then we'll straight up say shit like, these stuck up bitches won't fuck us, like, just because I'm not a cookie cutter guy with abs. And I'm like, really? I can see the no fat chick sticker on your binder, asshole. Everybody can get fucked. So if you're not getting fucked.
Do you guys remember Scott Peterson, the guy that killed his wife?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that guy got married after that. Okay.
Yeah.
And if you're an incel and you can't beat out Scott Peterson, a guy with a murder on his record, dude, what are you doing with yourself, bro? Get a chin.
But it was pretty amazing because when I found out what an incel was, I
I'm like, Brandon, we got to do a bit on incels. How about an incel divorce attorney? It's the first time Brandon's like, I'm on it. I love it. And I was like, wow, really?
Usually, yeah.
Really? Usually like, goes, he was all about this one.
Yeah. Pete usually is like, oh, Pete will give me an idea. And I'm like, we'll work on it.
Yeah. You
this
guys,
one, he was like,
you
I got
guys
it.
Agree got on bits as well as incels and women agree on having sex. Yes. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, exactly. Like, Pete is my polar opposite in every way. He's my polar opposite in every way.
That's what makes it worse. So moving on to that's what makes it worse.
I was right. What makes it worse?
No, I
hold
said it wrong.
On.
That was a Freudian.
That was Pete going, God, I wish I hated you so much more than
that's
I do.
That's what makes it worse.
Isn't it unfortunate that you have so much personal history with him and you can't just dump him?
Yeah, exactly.
I wouldn't want to. My life would suck without him.
I'm a part of you. Yeah, that's right.
Cute. If anybody doesn't know, I love Brandon Guchon.
Yeah, that's right.
I
that's
love you
right.
Guys. Oh.
And I love
right.
Jocelyn Shaw.
I love you guys.
Bonus in the mosh pit. Let's talk about another group of people
let's
that may
it.
Not love each other.
I don't think they love each other.
And that group of people is the original members of KISS.
See, here's the thing. When you look at KISS, okay, it's like I don't know.
I love that we haven't even started talking the story.
Yeah, you're just jumping
and
in without
Gucci's
even,
like,
yeah,
KISS. Yeah,
KISS. People might not know the story.
KISS is a prime example of, okay, like Pete and I are opposites, but it works. It's such a good partnership, okay?
Yeah.
But KISS, on the other hand, are opposites, and they hate, like, dude, Ace Frehley and Gene Simmons, like, when you see them go back and forth, and Gene Simmons is always kind of like, this is, like, Ace Frehley will totally blast Gene, and then Gene's response will be like, he's an idiot, that'll be it.
And this time, Gene didn't seem to me to blast Ace, but this is, let me say what Gene said. I'll do his part. I didn't think he blasted him, but you guys might feel differently. Ace and Peter have gotten, they're talking about, obviously, if you guys don't know, KISS are on their end of the time farewell type of tour, which is going to go on for 2 years.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Their end of the road tour that's been going on.
The apocalypse farewell tour.
Yeah, exactly. 15 not fucking year farewell tour. Thanks, guys.
Yes. There's going to be many incels there.
Yeah, right. Oh, shit.
I highly doubt that.
Yeah,
actually.
Exactly. I wonder if an incel shoots a woman, does he use
Oh, no. They won't be incels in the 70s. They were called IT guys.
If an incel shoots a woman at a KISS concert, is he going to use a love gun?
I hate you.
You're stupid.
I hate you and your stupid 80s music puns.
Love gun.
I'm a pun guy. So incelligent, like, killed me. For the bit, I'm like, incelligent.
Here's what I don't get.
I love it.
Here's what I don't get. I write something like incelligent, something so dumb, and Pete's like, Brandon, wow.
If you are about to defend chicken dick,
I am about to defend chicken dick because Pete hated it so much.
This right. is what Gene Simmons said to start the new battle
he
between the
him
two.
A chicken dick.
Ace and Peter have gotten three chances. They were in and out of the band, fired three times for drugs, alcohol, bad behavior, being unprofessional. They weren't carrying their load. So the short answer to your question is we'd love to have Ace and Peter join us here and there. And if they don't, it's not going to be because of us, but they're never going to be in KISS again. And that's full time. Is that blasting?
Here's what I heard. And this is maybe just me being a messy, dramatic bitch that I am because I am. And that's who I am.
Mm.
This is how I heard that. It sounded a lot like when, like, a girl breaks up with a guy, but like, or he dumps her and then she tries to make it sound like she wanted to break up with him. And she's like, well, I don't give a fuck anyways. It's like, I broke up with you three times already and your dick is little. You know,
wow.
Like,
wow.
That's what that sounded like to me.
Yes. See, that what you did there is probably what Ace did. And you filled in a lot of blanks, including little
yeah,
dicks.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Because that's not what he said.
Yeah. Ace was probably, yeah.
I'm just.
Ace didn't mention Gene's dick, but we all know.
I'm not saying I'm gesticulating.
Yeah.
But I'm gesticulating.
Just. Hick,
but people, I guess, understood that why Ace was upset with Gene from what I just said.
Well, and on top of that, I will say this in Gene Simmons' favor, there was one time where they brought it up about them getting inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and they wanted, everybody obviously wanted Ace and Peter to be involved. Well, they haven't been in the band. They've been out of the band longer than they were in the band.
Here's Ace's response to Gene. He's like, my reaction to Gene's post today, Gene, your memory is really incorrect. I was never fired from KISS. I quit twice, not three times, of my own free will, because you and Paul are control freaks.
And you had tiny dicks.
Pause.
Whoa.
That was you didn't break up with me. I broke up with you.
That was. That's exactly what it was. That's exactly what that was.
Continuing. untrustworthy and very difficult to work with. Your slanderous remarks about my bad habits over the years has cost me millions of dollars, and now that I'm 12 years sober, you're still saying I can't be trusted to play a whole night show. Well, that's exactly what I've been doing for the last 12 years with different configurations of the Ace Frehley Band to you and Paul's dismay. Also, the most successful solo artist to come out of the original Kiss lineup, and proud of it. You and Paul have tried to derail my solo career multiple times over the years, unsuccessfully.
I don't want to disrespect Ace, but I really think it's funny that he's like, I'm the most successful solo artist yes. to come out of Kiss. You're not like, what?
Right, exactly.
Calm down.
Right, because everybody...
You're not Beyonce. Yeah. What do you mean?
Continuing. I've tried to be nice and friendly by inviting you and Paul to perform on my past albums for E1 Music. Give each of you guys one of my prized Gibson Les Paul 59 models. But today's comments have made me realize you're just an asshole and a sex addict who's being sued by multiple women, and you're just trying to sweep it all under the carpet. The icing on the cake was when you groped my wife and propositioned her in Los Angeles at Capitol Records building behind my back when I was trying to help you out on one of your vault experiences.
Damn.
Shit.
Now that to me is like, okay, the gloves are off.
This is really strikes me of how pure and sweet Ace Frehley is because he's like, you're an asshole.
Yeah.
Like, that's his insult. That's such an old man insult.
Shall we continue?
Yes, go.
All right. This is what Ace demands. Without a complete heartfelt apology, an offer to give me my old job back, and removing Tommy from the throne that I created, the shit will hit the fan, and there'll be no stopping it. It's on. And then the corn beat came through.
Here's my thing, though, with Ace Frehley. I love that the gloves came off and his insults were asshole and sex addict.
Yes.
He's a very sweet man.
First off, yeah.
The gloves are off. You're an asshole, mister.
I think I would be going a little bit harder once somebody propositions my wife.
No,
you know
shit.
What I'm saying?
The fact that he said, like, he, like, felt her up and shit. Like,
yeah. Well, I mean, dude, that's what I'm saying. Like, Gene Simmons, like, when this whole Me Too thing came out, like, if you, you know, I was like, oh, Gene. Oh, how the mighty have fallen. And it's going to happen. It's going to happen.
So, moving on. You think that's the end of the drama? The gloves are off.
No,
well,
no.
Ace's longtime girlfriend, who he called his wife, is getting involved. And this is what she said. Her name was Rachel Gordon. And Ace calls her his wife, but he is still legally married to another woman named Jeanette.
I retract my previous statement about how nice Ace is? Right,
yeah, exactly. Ooh, Ace. Yeah, you're calling this guy a sex fiend, and meanwhile, you got it.
Yeah.
You're still married, and now you got a longtime girlfriend?
Yeah, have fun with your sister wives.
This is what Gordon said to add to the fire. Let me tell you, they tried to have Ace killed in the 70s. Tried setting him to... I can't even
read it. Jesus.
Let me try that again. Let me tell you, they tried to have Ace killed in the 70s. Tried sending him to a so-called private party in the Bahamas. Ace is very sober now and knows what's happening. He sees things clearly now. He doesn't need a chain of lowbrow restaurants. He plays the guitar. That's what he does. Fuck them. So...
Here's the thing. You could take that sentence and you could... insert it into the mouth of any woman in any dive bar with too much makeup, really wrinkly skin who smells like cigarettes, and just make her drunk. And she could be like, Kiss comes on the jukebox, and there's 30,000 women in the country right now drinking a Michelob Ultra going, they tried to kill Ace in the 70s.
You know they tried to kill Ace.
What?
They basically... Ace was on an airplane with Ted Kennedy. And what? No. You know,
they tried to kill Ace in the 70s
yeah, how
in the
did
Bahamas.
They do that? I have to know.
Like, and what is they?
Paul and Gene.
She literally means they. She literally means like...
That's what I want to know. Like, how did they try? Like, what did they try and poison him? I mean, like, was it Gene sneaking up behind him like, I'm going to get you, Ace? You know, like, no.
Okay,
dude, like,
well, if she's going to say that they try to kill Ace, and then
that's what I'm saying. That's
she
a
said she was groped
strong
by Gene,
accusation.
Which is also a strong accusation.
He groped me and then they tried to kill my husband.
Like, whoa. Yeah, yeah. He groped me and then he tried to kill my husband. The judge is going to be like, okay, well, look, it's either one or the other. Both can't happen at the same time. Murder and groping just don't go hand in hand.
To be fair, now that you're saying it like that, murder and groping do kind of go hand in
hand. That's what I'm saying. Yeah, it's peanut butter and jelly and grope and murder. It's the same damn thing.
Grope and murder, that's the other incel lawyer.
Yeah, okay, so... With the incel lawyers. Oh, yeah, incels. God, I can't get over it. Anyway, so the point is, guys, is this nonsense just absolutely heartbreaking nonsense? Does this matter? What Gene said, did it really deserve kind of backlash from Ace? Go.
First off, this is the same thing Gene has said for 30 fucking years.
Right.
It's not like he's saying anything new, okay? These aren't new accusations. What? Ace was on drugs. Oh, Gene, tell us more. The thing is this is Kiss. It's one of the great rock bands of all time, and there's a ton of drama within the band. Whenever Gene says anything about Ace or Peter, it's going to make a headline. And then, okay, Ace, what do you think about this? And then they're going to be like, well, you know, they're assholes. And then they fire back. Dude, this exchange, the only thing that's new, the only thing that is new is the groping and the murdering. That's the only thing that's new here. That's
Here's the thing, though, is that I feel like the world and the rock and metal world in particular treats Kiss like our like old senile grandpas. We're like, we let them like fight in the nursing home,
yeah,
but we don't get involved. Like we like watch it from afar, but none of us are like, we're like, we don't really care,
right?
But it's fun to watch them,
yeah,
fight.
It's like, oh, Walter Matthau. Yeah. We lost Walter Matthau, but we still got Gene, so thank you,
right?
You know? It's
Gene,
on
if Gene wins, does he get to watch Wheel of Fortune tonight or
no shit? Yeah, exactly.
Tool, Danny Carey says a new Tool album will be out in mid-April. What do you guys think?
Look, yes.
Oh, wow. What do you think?
I am saying yes because I'm going to manifest this shit because we've been waiting.
This is the first time.
We have to be positive and we have to say yes. And it's the first time that Maynard didn't make a smart-ass comment about it. So.
And it was the first time, too, that they actually gave us a month. Like, it wasn't like a year. It wasn't like some vague answer. He's like, look, it's going to be out in April. Like, that's the first time they ever did that. So I think it's going to happen, you know? But I did hear that Maynard tried to have Danny Carey's wife
in Puerto Rico in the 80s.
There was groping. No.
During Lateralis.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know how they stay together.
Hence the long gap between records.
Yeah. That's what it was. There was just, yeah, exactly. You know what? That'll break up a band for a couple of years, at least a decade.
Yeah, murder plot?
Yeah, murder plot. I mean, you could get together and play for an hour and a half and then go your
groping
separate ways.
Groping of a wife, you could get back together in a couple of weeks.
Right, right.
But
right,
murder plot, that's like a year.
You're like, yeah, Ace is just kind of like, look, we've shared women so many times. I'll let this one slide, Gene.
All right, and with that, guys. This month, Downfall of Gaia released their new album, Ethic of Radical Finitude, via Metal Blade Records. Ethic of Radical Finitude is the quartet's most melodic, structured, and dynamic release to date, and once more builds upon the epic and unique sludgy, crusty, exploratory metallic sound that has organically evolved with every release. Purchase your copy now at metalblade.com/downfallofgaia. Once again, metalblade.com/downfallofgaia. And with that, guys, let's jump into our interview with Dave Elfison of Megadeth. Everybody, what is going on? It's Petter with the Metal Sucks podcast on the phone. I got Dave Elfison, and we're here to talk about many, many things, but I want to make sure we put a spotlight on Altitudes and Attitudes' new record, Get It Out, which is out right now. Also, Megadeth's Greatest Hits record is coming out March 22nd, and Metal Allegiance just came out a few months ago. We got a lot to talk about, Dave. You've been busy.
Yeah, it's been a good little season of life right now.
Definitely, man. So let's start with Altitudes and Attitudes. So Get It Out, which is out now, as we mentioned, the essence is a rock and roll album to me. How long did you want to be part of a project that was more straightforward rock and roll?
Man, A&A, as we call it, just to help you shorten the vernacular, because I know it's a lot of vowels and consonants to trip over when you say Altitudes and Attitudes. So we'll call it A&A for short. You know, it just developed just effortlessly, became a labor of love and a real passion for me and Frank, and something we, from the very first three songs we did on that EP we pushed out about 5 years ago, we just continuously just, you know, diligently kept working on what became this full length. And, you know, we just loved it. It was, for us, it was just a real sweet spot. It just resonated well with us. And, you know, then comes the day when you release it and you put it out there, and, you know, then it's kind of out there for the world to hear. And it's a bit, you know, beyond your control if people like it or not. But, you know, it's been received very, very well. Everybody from our, most importantly, our fans, you know, have just really loved it. Obviously radio and people are talking about it, and probably just that it's kind of this unexpected, really genuine, heartfelt surprise for everybody. And I think people are really happy to hear Frank and I collaborating. They're happy to hear us doing something very unexpected. You know, it seems like people think it's actually pretty good, which is awesome.
So do you think doing the EPs and stuff like that helped get the full length to where it is?
Yeah, I mean, the EP was just, you know, we put it out because it's all the songs we had, you know. We only had three songs, and we loved it, and, you know, Megaforce was into supporting it, and, you know, kind of like now we had this little window where we could push it out, and, and running up the flagpole, and yeah, that began sort of the musical bromance, if you will, of what Frank and I do. And, you know, then as we started putting the full length together, you know, I was bringing in a whole wide smattering of ideas, everything from that bass riff, which is Leviathan, to riffs in Part of Me, different lyrical things. I was kind of bringing in pieces. Frank was bringing in pretty much completed songs that he would compose when he was at home, just playing acoustic guitar and singing and writing things. So, you know, between the two of us, we brought some very different things to the table, and it was just really, really calming how we just met in the middle with it. You know, it's a very collaborative work that we have here with this thing. And you're right. It's you know, you can definitely hear the Cheap Trick and Kiss. I go back to Joe Jackson's bass player, Graham Mabey. He is really was my influence for the bass playing on this record, and as somebody who had an impact on me, God, I think probably 1978 or 79, I saw him play on a Saturday morning TV show that had Joe Jackson on it right when he was really in his prime, when he was coming up the ranks. And I just remember that Graham's bass playing. I was like, holy cow, this guy's such a cool bass player. Played with a pick and played these very melodic, aggressive bass lines behind this kind of pop music, you know, and you know, it's kind of new wave music, I guess. And that just really was my inspiration as a bass player. When I played bass to Frank songs, you know, I think for me, I always write. I have a ton of stuff, bass riffs, guitar riffs, lyric ideas. And, you know, it's fun to bring them to the table and just, you know, kind of bring these parts to the ingredients to the table and let me and Frank flush out a recipe from it.
And Leviathan is the instrumental track, and the riff does stand out very much. Was it chosen that way because you were such a fan of the riff that you brought in for that song?
Yeah, it was this piece, and I kind of had the whole piece of music, you know, moving sort of the modulation of it from, you know, E to A, and, you know, kind of that, the what essentially was like a verse riff. And I had that whole piece of music, and I brought that in, and Frank and Jay Rustin, who produced, who's also a bass player, they loved it, and they're like, wow, that's super cool. And I actually kept thinking about, should we put lyrics on it? And it was one of these things that just didn't seem to call for a lyric. And when we sent it over to Satchel from Steel Panther, what he brought back on the guitar parts was just took it to another level. It reminded me very much of like the first Michael Schenker group album, some of the instrumental stuff he did on there on that album. And so we just decided, you know what, this a lyric would only get in the way. Let's just let the music do the talking.
And let's talk about your formative years. In your formative years, punk rock was rising and rock music was mainstream. Now, which do you feel you were drawn to more growing up?
You know, when I was, you know, my very first musical kind of impact, I mean, because I heard music, of course, in the radio, Neil Diamond, you know, to, you know, country and Western music growing up on the farm in Minnesota. But the stuff that really had impact for me was Styx, Bachman Turner Overdrive, early Kiss, the first couple of Foreigner records. Even early Chicago, you know, that stuff that I heard on, you know, AM radio. By today's standard, it would probably be considered active rock radio, you know. But those are like the heavier things that I liked. But, you know, then by the late 70s, I mean, that was when I was, you know, really a bass player. I was becoming studying and becoming a skilled musician, starting to write some of my own songs. You know, the stuff that was around then was, you know, Cheap Trick, In Color, and Heaven Tonight. Obviously, the first pretty much Kiss up through Kiss Alive 2. And then, you know, the Sex Pistols and punk rock was happening. Also, disco was happening. And I think a lot of, you know, people probably from my age group, we would never at the time admit that we listened to disco. But, you know, disco had some of the best bass lines in the business. And I would always kind of secretly listen to it and go, that's some really good bass playing right there. And I never, you know, even the first early Van Halen stuff, you know, kind of up through Women and Children First, you know, that those early Van Halen records, I'd say probably up through Fair Warning. That was my Van Halen era. You know, I could hear Michael Anthony sort of playing these octave disco bass lines just because it's what was around at that time. So I'd say everything from hard rock to disco to punk rock. And then also, you know, the skinny tie new wave movement that was coming in. And again, that would be the Cars, Joe Jackson, Donny Iris was another movement that really had a big impact on me just because it's what was around at that time. And I definitely derived my bass playing from all of those genres.
I've talked to many guys where they're like, yeah, we'd have our records out. When our friends came over, we'd pull out records and we'd have our secret record collection like in our closet. Did you have that situation?
Oh, yeah. I mean, me and my best friend, Greg Handovit, you know, he grew up in a city and then moved to my little town of Jackson, Minnesota. So he was kind of like my brother from another mother. And he is the one who turned me on to things like, you know, he helped me go much deeper with my musical experiences. You know, I'd go to his house and because he had cable, because he lived in town. I lived out on the farm, so we had like the UHF and VHF antenna. You know, but Craig lived in town and had cable, so we'd stay up at night and watch the Midnight Special once in a while, maybe Don Kirshner's rock concert, things like that. But the Midnight Special had great stuff. I mean, I remember seeing Rubicon, which had Jack Blades, and I think maybe Jeff Watson, who then became members of Night Ranger years later. I remember watching Ronnie Montrose and seeing Stanley Clark, Black Oak Arkansas. You know, these kind of bands were very popular then, and Greg really helped expand my musical palette. And that, even in our bands that we had growing up together, you know, that's where I started to get into Zeppelin and Sabbath, and, you know, bands that were kind of, by and large, were you know, had already kind of reached their peak, and in some cases, you know, members were dying and disbanding, like The Who. Well, The Who carried on, I guess, but Keith Moon died, John Bonham died, and Sabbath, you know, was, you know, Sabbath and Blue Oyster Cult and things like that. You know, Greg really helped expand my musical palette beyond just like kind of the mainstream things that were on the radio at that time.
Now, music for a kid, especially in that generation when you're talking about, there is this illusion that it is just amazing. Now, what was the biggest illusion of the rock and roll life that you only discovered after success?
Illusion or delusion? Illusion, I guess. You know, I think, you know, we, for like my genre, right? And mm-hmm. Certainly me and Frank Bello talk about this all the time. You know, Kiss was they were our Beatles. You know, they were the ones that changed our lives. They were larger than life. It was this untouchable, mythical figure. The posters on our walls, you know, we bought magazines just because they had anything about Kiss in them. and then in our own bands, we did everything they did. We tried, you know, making very crude and probably highly dangerous, you know, flash pots and fire bombs and taping our picks to the mic stand like they did. You know, we tried to do everything that they did. They were really the ones that turned the big corner for us. And another band called Angel that was also on Casablanca Records, they're another one of those bands that, you know, had this sort of impact to us. And then I think probably by the time, let's say by the early 90s, when all of our bands we're starting to have our own big, you know, platinum and multi-platinum successes. And, you know, we had our own fan bases and we were essentially the Kiss of the next generation. You know, you realize that, you know, you still wake up, you still brush your teeth, put your pants on one leg at a time. And, you know, that there's this public life that you get to enjoy. But yet, you know, I'm still little Davey, the human dude, you know, in my day to day encounters. And I think that's probably the illusion sort of gets stripped away. You know, I think probably the bigger challenge is finding the balance within that, you know, that you don't get lost in buying your own press, you know, that you, stay somewhat rooted in reality. And I think, you know, that's, you know, rock and roll consumes its young, you know, so I think probably for all of us, we're very lucky to have survived it.
What was most uncomfortable for your personality?
You know, I when I moved to LA, I got here and I was ready to throw it all on the table and sell my soul for rock and roll. I mean, I didn't move here half-heartedly. I moved here like, deal me in, I'm in, let's go, you know. And now that all has one appearance when you're sitting comfortably in the basement of your parents' farmhouse. And, you know, I grew up, pretty comfortable in farmers made a lot of money in the 70s. So I was pretty comfortable. So I didn't know anything else. And then moving from Mayberry to, you know, Hollywood Boulevard with, you know, pimps and prostitutes and, you know, and everything else, the, you know, the seedy underbelly of an entertainment capital. And seeing that, like, you know, anything, you know, it's like the crazier and more insane you are, the better it is in Hollywood, because it looks good on the silver screen. It looks, works good in TV. It sells records. That was probably the uncomfortable thing. 'Cause I was like, wait a minute, I'm not that guy. You know, I'm a pretty sane, normal, balanced individual. I just have this love for playing music. I have this love for rock and roll and hard rock and metal. And I just, I, you know, that's what I want to do from a kind of, you know, from a performer point of view, but also from a craftsman point of view, you know? So I think, you know, somehow threading the needle through all of the external elements of Hollywood. And I sit in Hollywood actually right now as I do this interview with you. I'm here right now, you know, so it's interesting that we're talking about this, because last night, you know, me and Frank were at Musicians Institute, a school I almost went to. And then I met Dave and we started Megadeth. So I did end up going. And, you know, last night we all went over to the Rainbow and had dinner. And, you know, the Rainbow now, you know, is a place where, like, people talk business and deals are made. And, you know, we're talking about cannabis and CBD and coffee. And, you know, it used to be the place where you would go to, you know, that's where, you know, we, us lowly struggling musicians would hopefully go to try to find some girl that would take us in, that, that we could live at her place until we went on tour again. And, you know, it was sex, drugs, and rock and roll. I mean, it was the height and the heyday of everything you ever heard about of the 80s Sunset Strip rock and roll. You know what I mean? So it's like, as a pre-20-something going to the Rainbow, and then in my early 20s going there and hanging out and doing all sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and now going there as like a, you know, it's just noticing, I'm just going, my God, it's like they're still playing Guns N' Roses. They're still playing some of the old, you know, music from the 80s. And 90s, but this looks nothing like the 80s, you know, anymore. It's like a place to have dinner and broker deals now.
I wonder if just all the people that were, you know, visited back then just kept going there, and then they grew up a little bit, so now it kind of turned into that. So maybe there wasn't like another...
It very, very much so. Yeah, you know, my partner Tom, who we do, you know, all the Ellison Industries together, you know, the label and the coffee and everything, and he said that, he goes, you know, when I got here, it was the '90s. I missed everything that you're telling me about at the Rainbow. He goes, to me, the Rainbow always was this place. I said, God, I mean, I remember, you know, the stuff that used to go on in the back toilet, in the back bathroom. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, just the decadence and crazy and chaos. And we loved it. I mean, it was great. It was the VIP line and the who's who. I mean, David Lee Roth is in one booth, and, you know, Billy Sheehan sitting over at that booth, and, you know, Guns N' Roses guys are over there. You know what I mean? It was like opening up Circus Magazine, and that's what was happening at the Rainbow, you know, and that's why everybody wanted to go there. It was just the cool place to go, you know, and I didn't even know they had food. I didn't even know they had a kitchen and had a menu, because we would just go drink the Long Island iced teas, and now we go there and order chicken soup and pizza, you know?
Yes, that's awesome. But the love of creating music, that was always at the core when you started. A&A and Metal Allegiance, if we can put them together, that is kind of what those projects seem to be about, is the love of creating music. Was there ever a stage in your career when that wasn't the focus?
You know, first of all, you're right. You're absolutely right about Metal Allegiance and A&A. There's a musical alliance based on a friendship allegiance, you know, and I think those two are very much intertwined into those, which is what makes them fun, and which is what makes us look forward to doing them. You know, but the 90s were not easy for heavy metal artists. And I think that was a real eye-opener for all of us, because, you know, we got to get things going in the 80s. We started to get success. We got a major label. We really felt like things were building to a crescendo. And little did we know that, you know, by the mid-90s, we were going to be on the backside of a big wave that we all got to surf in, you know. And that was because times changed. You know, Seattle music was popular. All the radio and MTV formats were changing. And metal bands, we really, if you didn't want to become extinct, you had to somehow adapt and sort of you know, navigate these new waters. And for probably at least 10 years, well into probably the early 2000s, maybe even mid 2000s, there was a tricky 10-12 year period there for all metal bands, especially thrash metal bands. And the thing that happens as a thrash metal band is you also grow up and you get older. You know, you grow up, you get married, you have kids, you start thinking about, like, you know, you're not really your mortality because you're too young to think about dying yet, but you're sort of thinking about, you know, middle age things. And all of a sudden, you know, you realize, you know, this thing we started when we were 18, 19, 20 years old, and this young, brash kind of punk rock thing, you know, that we started, you start to kind of go, God, does this really run concurrent with my age and my lifestyle and kind of being a middle aged guy? And I think we all went through it. I think every one of us. It was reflected in musical changes, haircut styles, you know, there was just a lot of it, you know, that changed. And also you can't help but be somewhat affected by the external things that are happening. New genres of music that are coming in. You're watching new fans grow up. I'm, you know, we took Korn out with us in 1995. And I remember a couple years later, I was sitting in this gathering, this kind of a youth group gathering. And these two girls next to me the one girl, I remember she looked at her friend and she said, "Are you ready?" You know, which is the opening line of the, you know, Jonathan Davis's opening line of that Korn album. And I just looked at that and I went, oh my God, like, I'm officially like of the previous generation, you know, like new kids aren't listening to Megadeth as the new cool band now. Now Korn's the new cool band, you know? And so you're going through all these transitions, you know, and I think the fact that I think that's probably what made the Big Four so cool in 2010 is I think as much as anything, it was a celebration that the four pillars of this genre called thrash metal actually survived it. And we were able to come together as a force and celebrate a scene and a genre that we created together. And I don't know of another genre that has four, you know, again, I call them the pillars, you know, the four corners of the house in which the structure is built, you know. And there's a lot of other bands, of course, that are part of the genre, but kind of the, you know, the four founding fathers that had, you know, the goods to, you know, do the independent deals. And then we got signed to the major deals. And then we got, you know, hooked up with the bigger tours, Ozzy, Maiden, Alice Cooper, you know, the big guys that took us out, and, you know, Ronnie Dio and these guys that took us under their wing and helped raise our careers up, you know. And I can't think of another one, you know. The jam band genre, you know, that's not there. And, you know, so we're really fortunate that we have this scene that we can celebrate together. And look, it's the fans. I mean, the celebration. I mean, we really, I know people say, oh, we wouldn't be here without the fans. But it's true. I mean, it's like, if we didn't have fans buying our records and buying those concert tickets for the Big Four, I mean, we wouldn't have been playing stadiums, you know. We'd be limping along trying to pack some frickin' jamboree or something.
And the only one I can think of is marred with tragedy. And that was, what are you talking about, the Seattle movement? When you look at, you got Pearl Jam, Nirvana, Alice in Chains, and Soundgarden. They can't do what you guys did because of all the tragedies that affected each one of those bands, amazingly enough.
I know. It really is. And it's sad because, you know, the singers of those groups, you know, who are so iconic and really spoke the language to that scene. I mean, I remember in 91 coming home off the Clash of the Titans, actually coming home from Europe, and we had just met Alice in Chains, and we were negotiating getting them as the opening band on the Clash of the Titans tour because they had supported us in Europe. It was Megadeth, the Almighty, and this little opening band called Alice in Chains. And we always thought their name was kind of funny until we saw them play. And we went up, we're like, holy shit, these guys are amazing. And I remember we called home to management immediately and said, oh my God, this is the band. And Scott Ian liked them, and everybody else from you know, the Slayer, Megadeth, Anthrax camp got on board with getting Alice in Chains on the tour that summer, the Clash of the Titans tour that we did across North America. And, you know, I just remember the sound of it, you know, the dropped tuning that Jerry Cantrell was doing. I remember dropping my guitar at home, go, ooh, that is freaking cool. You put your finger in the same position, but new sounds come out. and, you know, I took a couple of those ideas into Megadeth, and obviously that didn't fly because that's not what we do. But I hung on to that, you know, some things I did later in my career with F5 and some things like that that I did. I utilized that, and it was fun working with young musicians who grew up not only on Megadeth, but grew up on a lot of that stuff from the 90s. They really understood the tuning. They understood sort of the lyrical content. And, you know, those vocalists from the Seattle movement, you know, they spoke a language to a new generation in the same way we spoke a language to our generation.
You did bring up Megadeth, and we are expecting a new Megadeth record this year. And you are following up Dystopia, which was universally acclaimed pretty much by all the metal fans. Now, what Megadeth record in your career was the hardest to follow up in the studio?
The hardest to follow, you know, probably when we went in to do the Risk album. You know, we with Cryptic Writings, we, again, what we were just talking about, the 90s and this unfavorable metal climates, and we had gone through a management transition out of Euthanasia, and we had three records with that team. We had Rust in Peace, Countdown, and Euthanasia. But clearly by the time we started writing Cryptic Writings, which was 1996, the climate had definitely changed. And we were, you know, we're just going, man, we can't just sit here and just make a thrash metal record. It's just not going to work. And at the same time, inside of us, we discovered we could write things like Symphony of Destruction and Train of Consequences, these kind of more mid-tempo songs that had these big choruses. And, you know, the mainstream had embraced Megadeth, so we felt, you know, we should continue to serve that community as well as, you know, not certainly abandon our thrash roots and, you know, kind of the heart center of the band. So, you know, it's interesting because we had management that really helped us get our mind around the writing with Cryptic Writings. And we had a really successful album worldwide. We really hit the target. You know, we hit the bullseye with that one. And then, you know, I think when we went in to do Risk, there was another culture that was starting to happen, which was this new metal thing. Two bands in particular, probably Godsmacked and Disturbed, had really started to turn that, and they were going heavier, and we made an album that actually went lighter. And I still like the Risk album. I think it's got some really cool songs on it, but it just, as a friend of mine put it, when we zigged when the rest of the world zagged. And I'll never forget, because we did we went over to England, and we had Godsmack opening for us, and they were, you know, just kind of a new band and kind of getting their sound together. And I don't know, maybe 6 months later, we played Woodstock together, and Godsmack supported us. They played right before us, and they were just ferocious and crushing. I mean, you could really hear like, wow, this is a band who's like they're finding their way, you know. And I remember it being a startling moment, because going, wait a minute, we're going to go follow that up with Breadwine and, you know, the sort of lighter material we had on the Risk album. Again, we were just being Megadeth. We were just doing what we were doing, you know. But it, again, just like the early 90s when Seattle came in and changed the external sources around us, you know, the Godsmack, you know, kind of, I'll never see them call it new metal, but whatever that genre was, this sort of new radio, this heavy radio rock genre that was happening around us, really, it sort of really mirrored back how different Megadeth was from all of that, you know. And I think that really set out probably the next, you know, I don't know, probably the next decade. You know, and that was a period that I wasn't in Megadeth, but I saw what Dave was doing and I got it. He was really trying to recorrect Megadeth to get it back on course, back to its real origins of where we started, you know, of being this riff based, you know, heavy and thrashing band again.
You brought up Risk. So let me ask you, the two most polarizing records for fans, and Megadeth, you guys have 16, if I'm correct, or 16th is coming out this year.
Right.
Is Risk and Super Collider. Which one are you a bigger fan of?
Well, you know, it's funny. Super Collider is funny. I don't listen to, you know, it's so funny. We're so busy, obviously, doing Megadeth stuff that, you know, we're kind of in the moment of whatever songs we're playing and, you know, working on. It's funny, the Risk songs worked great acoustically because they were these really simple kind of singer-songwriter kind of songs almost, right? And, you know, Super Collider has a lot of really heavy stuff on it. It's definitely a much heavier record. I think with Super Collider, you know, the setup and the launch of that record really, I think, is what really polarized that album with the fans. Is, you know, had we led with kind of the traditional format, which is you come out with a heavy track and then you move to the single, if we had come out with Kingmaker and then moved to Super Collider, that record would have been received completely different. Because first impressions are lasting impressions. Yeah. You know, there's this big weight, like, you know, Megadeth were doing the Big Four. We did all this big stuff. And Slayer, Megadeth, Anthrax tours again. I mean, we're back on top as this real thrash band. And then all of a sudden, the next song people hear from us is the Super Collider track. It was like, whoa, what the hell happened? And Super Collider is a perfectly fine song if it was the second song you heard. But to come out of the gate swinging with something like Kingmaker would have set an entirely different precedent. So it's amazing how you can skew public opinion by what you see and hear first. And so I think Super Collider has a lot of heavy tracks on it. You know, there's a lot of pretty crushing material on that one. So I'm probably a bigger fan overall of the Super Collider album. When I hear it now, I remember and go, God, that had some pretty freaking crushing stuff on it.
It's funny you said that, because I remember seeing you guys open for Maiden, and you guys pulled out Kingmaker. And I'm out here in Las Vegas, so, and I saw the whole crowd singing to Kingmaker. I'm like, this is the record, right, that nobody seemed to like that much. But, like, you're right. So that song came over really well live, I mean, without a shadow of a doubt. I mean, so people don't give full records the same chance that they used to back in the day. That first impression is all they give it. You feel that's a fair assessment?
I totally agree. I mean, again, same with the Risk album. I mean, Prince of Darkness is an awesome song. And we used to open it when we did the Risk tour. We used to open with it. In fact, we've been using it as part of our intro tape for those last few years. You know, part of the intro graphics and everything that starts the show. Because it's a cool track. And but you're right. It's like, you know, when you make an album, you're telling a story. And not only is every song a story, but there's sort of a bigger narrative of when you combine them all together, which is why we usually, you know, write and record an abundance of material, and then we have to narrow it down to the 11 or 12 songs that actually go on the album. And it's funny because, you know, you look at like all the stuff we did in the 80s, those records only had like 8 songs on. And I remember when we mastered, me and Dave would go to the mastering lab, where they would literally cut the lacquer from which they would then print, they would manufacture all the vinyl from. And I remember the mastering guys here in Hollywood, they would always tell me, they said, you know, this album, even though it's like 32 minutes long, is the perfect length for mastering because the grooves are really wide because there's not a lot of material on it. So the grooves are wide, therefore you're getting a lot of big bottom end and you're really getting kind of the maximum sonic spectrum from our records. And it's weird how that changed in the 90s. And I think, you know, like contracts changed. All of a sudden now they wanted 11 songs. And, you know, then, you know, later in the late 90s and early 2000s, it's like, well, now we got to give us a special track to Target and a special track to Best Buy. And, you know, Japan always wants an extra track to kind of help stop the bootlegging and the importing. And, you know what I mean? So there's that kind of all these little extra songs you have to have. Next thing you know, we're like having to write, you know, 25 songs to get 15 killer ones to you know, satisfy the requests from all around the world. And that's a lot of work, man. It's a big workload to continually just keep cranking out, you know, that much material. I mean, you know, I remember when, again, growing up as a kid, Kiss would put out records every 9 months. They'd be doing tours, and again, the touring wasn't as extensive back then, because now, you know, we go everywhere. We go to Asia, we could do full Latin America tours, we go to Australia and India, and, you know, I mean, there's territories we tour now that weren't even, you know, open to tour in back then, you know. So it was probably easier, you know, to, you know, there's more time to write songs and make records. But, you know, these days, that's why it takes so long. I mean, we you know, the tours are a year and a half, 2 years long. And sometimes you go back a couple times, you know, because now there's festivals and there's all this different stuff that's out there to play. But I you know, I like that now Megadeth, we're in this season of our career where when you're a young band, you have to make an album because that triggers the tour cycle and it puts it all in motion. Now we've got, again, you know, 15 albums out there. So there's enough material to choose from that we can go play and, you know, do boot camps and cruises and play on festivals, and we can do a bunch of stuff and not always have to be predicated around, well, we can't book you until your new album comes out. You know, we're kind of past those days now.
Man, I got to tell you, like, you got so much for me to promote right now. So Megadeth is something that, I mean, I got so many more questions. I want to ask about Bass Story. I want to ask about your label, but I know we're short on time. So I just want to put everything out there, Dave. And if I forget something, let me know. First and foremost, Altitudes and Attitudes, New Records, Get It Out, is out right now. So make sure you guys pick that up. And then also, Metal Allegiance, Volume 2, Power Drunk Majesty, just came out a few months back. Excellent record. Megadeth, Greatest Hits, Warheads on Foreheads is coming out March 22nd. So make sure you guys pick that up. You guys are going on tour with Ozzy Osbourne starting May, June, and July all summer, right? Opening for him. And then also, yep, on your record label, you were going to finally release the third LP by the band Last Crack, which is, I think their last record came out in 91. So, and then right. You have the coffee. Man, I got to tell you, you got so much going on for you. Do you love being this busy all the time and just having all these projects happening?
Well, you know, I do actually. I mean, I'm 54. I feel like I'm 24, but, and I hope I'd still look maybe at least 34 or maybe 44. But, you know, the reality of it is it's just a great season of life, you know, and my attitude is, if not now, when? So let's do it.
Absolutely, man. Hey, I want to thank you, Dave, so much for calling in to the Metal Sucks podcast, man. It's been an absolute pleasure to chat with you.
You're welcome. So likewise, and thanks for all your support to everything.
Before we get to the song, I want to remind you guys that this show is sponsored by Rockabilia. Need to stock up on some of your favorite band's merch? Go to rockabilia.com and put some on your wish list. They're the one-stop shop for all your band merch needs. Need to buy a gift for someone and you know what bands they're into? Pick up something from Rockabilia. You won't be disappointed with the selection, and you can get 10% off with the code PCJabberJaw. So head on over to rockabilia.com and use the promo code PCJabberJaw and save 10% today.
Just try to be done, nothing in the way. The Metal Sucks Podcast. We'll be right back. The Metal Sucks Podcast.
Back, guys. First song you heard, guys, is off Altitudes and Attitudes' new record, Get It Out. That is the title track, and that record is out now. Second song you heard, Metal Allegiance's Power Drunk Majesty Volume 2, which came out a couple months back. That song is called The Accuser, featuring Trevor Sternad of the Black Dahlia Murder. Last song you heard is from a band called Brick by Brick, guys. Their record, Hive Mentality, will be out February 22nd, and that is the title track off of that album. Ace.
Look, I just want to...
Gene.
I need the Metal Sucks people to understand something. If you're in a band and your guitar player isn't up to par, you can just kick him out of the band. You don't have to murder him.
Or you could take him to the Caribbean.
Mm.
And then...
At a private party.
Grope his wife.
Grope his wife behind a record place.
All right. With that, guys,
I haven't forgot, Gene!
All our incel listeners, stop.
Stop.
But do call Grope and Murder and Associates if you need help.
Grope and Murder and Associates, yes, exactly. The law offices of Grope and Murder.
The Metal Sucks Podcast is signing off.
This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network.